Today's talk is given by Professor Chris Libben, Chair in Geography here at the University of Edinburgh. His talk is entitled Death Registers, Historic IQ Measures, Marriage Certificates, Mapping Our Past and Reconstructing Our Life Courses. Professor Dibben's research looks at a range of health and behavioural geography topics. He's previously worked at the universities of St Andrews and Oxford on, amongst other subjects, epidemiological studies into recovery after heart attacks, the causes of low birth weights, survival of drug misusers, and the impact of air pollution. He also contributed to work on the UK NHS health funding formula and on measuring health inequalities, for example, developing the Health Poverty Index for the Department of Health and Information Centre, that's within the NHS. Other work includes the development of national deprivation indices across the UK and in South Africa, and evaluations of government area-based initiatives. Finally, he is interested in the vulnerability of communities to natural hazards. Chris is also involved in a number of big projects, such as the Administrative Data Research Network and Administrative Data Liaison Service, as well as the Longitudinal Studies Centre Scotland and the Scottish Longitudinal Studies Development and Support Unit. There you go. These forming only a small statistical sample, perhaps, of the work he undertakes. Who could be better placed to speak to us today about life courses and where long-term studies might be heading? Chris.
Thanks, Simon. Thank you, everybody, for coming this afternoon. So, I was thinking about this this talk, and I guess recent talks, probably in this kind of environment, talking about big data and how it's affecting research, particularly spatial research, would be focusing on things like tweets, Facebook, social media. So, if you like, little segments of somebody's life captured with a phrase, text, and often geocoded. That's a lot of the excitement in this area. In contrast to that, I, over the last 4 or 5 years, have become increasingly interested in how these little moments of life are actually captured historically. So, moments of people's lives over the last 100 and 150 years. Now, these are often in administrative systems, so routine. So, I'm going to focus a lot today on civil events, so birth, deaths, and marriages, and how those are recorded in records. But I think this area, which I guess was once just the preserve of archivists, historians, so spending a lot of time recovering this data, increasingly because of digitization and other methods that allow this data to be more readily available, is suddenly moving, I think, into this area that's much closer to these modern forms of data. Now, I'm going to talk about one set of projects, but there's actually a number of projects in Edinburgh, for example, Richard's Mesh project, that is similarly looking to bring these historical records into an electronic format that then allows a movement away from very focused historical studies, sort of biographies of individuals, then through to whole populations. And then by linking these records together, allowing the construction of life courses, so an individual's life, and indeed, and we're hoping to move beyond this, then actually linking life courses together to, so children to their parents, to create intergenerational data sets, so you can look at the transfer of various things between individuals. Now, one of the interesting outcomes of these kind of large-scale data sets is that these are often on the very large population, sometimes in effect censuses of the population, and also that these records often have a geolocation of them. So what I'm hoping to explore today and illustrate is then how these historical data sets then really are opening up the new areas in terms of spatial research, because we have this information potentially now on very large populations in all parts of Scotland in this instance. And therefore we can start thinking about applying similar techniques to the ones that are being used in this very rich, deep, big data, among the contemporary data, these historical data sets. Now, I was hoping to show some results of research. Unfortunately, the bit of the study which I thought I'd get some results from is a little bit delayed. So what I'm going to talk to you about today is really the methods that need to be used in constructing these data sets. So I'm going to show some results, but it's the results of the methodologies. So I should first of all acknowledge that the work I'm going to show today comes from a large group. It's a group gathered to work under the Digitising Scotland project, which is an ESRC project, although the Wellcome Trust provided some earlier funding for the work. So this is a consortium group across the University of St Andrews, Edinburgh and Cambridge. And here's the group. Actually, quite a few of the people in this research group are in this room. And I might flag them on particular areas. So if you want particular to discuss particular issues, I can locate the correct person to talk to. Okay, so what was I planning to cover today? Well, I'll start off by talking about some of the research motivation and really look a bit to the very important research that has emanated from similar studies, and then really think about how the kind of data sets that's been created here may allow us to do this in Scotland, but also how we might expand with the more extensive data that's coming into use. So then I'll go on to talk about the task which we have within this study, which is to produce value, as I said, live course and intergenerational data that will enable spatial questions. So that means translating these records, these fragments of people's lives, into research usable data, linking together. I'm not actually going to talk about the linking today, but we have work on that. And then also the geolocation to ask the spatial questions. So now the problem and why we have to think innovatively about methodologies is that by the nature these are large data sets, they're somewhat messy, and the messiness comes from the way we have to process them. These are digitized historical records, but on the whole there's been some form of transcription. At the moment that's actually usually somebody typing it in, either a volunteer through some sort of crowdsourcing approach, or a company that's been paid to do this. But you'll see from when I showed you some of the records that the handwriting is often difficult to read. So there's a natural error in that. So it's working with these large, messy data sets using a language about the events we're interested in that doesn't naturally fit into a structure that we can use in research. So this requires methodologies from across the disciplines. And so we've been working very closely with computer scientists, people working in machine learning, in natural language processing, but also thinking about how we can exploit the information in these records to help with this process of producing something that's research usable. Okay, so let me quickly just start with the motivation then, and really just look to a few classic studies that are of this nature. In other words, that have looked to link up historical records, often administrative records, sometimes quite by happen chance, looking at important events that have really moved forward science and understanding. So I've just picked on three or four that I think have been particularly important. So the first one to talk about is then the Dutch famine birth cohort, which centres around the 1944 famine that took place in Northern Holland during the Second World War, around the withdrawal, the advance of Allied troops and the withdrawal of German troops, that for a short period, then you had a whole population that had incredible food shortages. So it was a very short period that was well understood. Now, what happened was that, in terms of the science then, this event was recognised as a useful, what we might call natural experiment, in a sort of a experimental terminology. We had, in particular, mothers exposed, children in utero, so pregnant women exposed then to the shortage of food. And then we had both their siblings around them at that time, but other children born in that period, or close to that period, which weren't exposed to that food shortage. And then this this led then to the identification of what's become known as the thrifty phenotype, which is the impact then of having a food shortage in utero on later life. So what was found within this study, and it was one of the key important studies in understudy to understand epigenetics, or the more fluid aspects that lies across our genome was that the body is, and this is the argument, is prepared then for life by this exposure in utero. So children that, mothers that were pregnant, the children then experienced the food shortages, then seemed far more vulnerable once they, in later life, entered to a period where there was no food shortage, to be far more vulnerable to cardiovascular disease, diabetes. The argument goes that their body was prepared for food shortages in utero. What was interesting, though, as these data was linked over time, and so generations were linked, was actually that this effect was passed on to another generation. So it wasn't just the generation that was experienced in utero. So the importance then of historical records linked over time. So another study that pushed forward this and provided evidence of epigenetic inheritance over generations is the Overkalax, if there's any Swedes in the audience, please excuse my pronunciation, study, which looked in a similar way then to food shortages and then the experiences of generations whose ancestors had been exposed, and importantly, male ancestors and female ancestors to food shortages. And actually what that study started establishing was that this thrifty phenotype type effect, the epigenetic intergeneration effect, then was passed on differently between genders. So again, linking over time, and in this case, relying on historical records into the 19th century. So the food shortages being measured by historical records of food production. In the UK then, similarly, there's been studies that's linked these historical records to the UK longitudinal studies that was very important in establishing health inequalities as an important political dimension for analysis in the UK and then more broadly. And importantly, establishing that inequalities that exist, so where that there's an unequal distribution of ill health and mortality between different social classes. This wasn't to do with the residualization of health, with the unhealthy going down the social scale because of perhaps losing a job. But actually, the social class position seemed to be the important causal effect. And that was possible because mortality records were linked to census records over time. So some really important studies then from linking historical records over time. Now in Scotland, there's existing studies. In some ways, we're pushing forward forms of these studies. So a very important one has been the Lothian birth cohort studies that set up by Ian Deary and John Starr in psychology. And this is following up two cohorts, as you can see, those born in 1921 and 36, that, again by chance, at aged 11, both sat experienced quite a unique event, I think unique in the world, because in 1932 and 1947, all 11-year-olds in Scotland sat a cognitive aptitude test, so all 11-year-olds, so some 60 to 70,000. Now, linking those data over time then provides a very rich data source, which Ian and John have particularly used to try and understand neurodegenerative diseases over time, so cognitive degeneration in older life, and trying to understand then what early life exposures might, and its prediction of these conditions later life. And here's the part of that cohort. And what we've done working with Ian actually is to start to this process of then constructing a new cohort based on these administrative data. So what we've done is actually taken forward people who sat this test in 1947, who then linked forward into our existing Scottish longitudinal study, which is a 5% sample of the Scottish population. So, for relatively low cost, what we were able to achieve here, although with a fairly small sample, this is only about 3,500 individuals. But by seeking out their records at these early points in life, so in 1939 through national registration system, just before the Second World War, we have a record of their early life environment, their household. Then we have this cognitive ability test in 1947. So, and then the rich information from the existing study. So by linking then this data together then, fairly cheaply producing quite a detailed, rich cohort study. Of course, the important thing with this compared to traditional cohorts is that this can be done retrospectively. The great weakness of the traditional cohort, where you set up a study and follow people over time, it needed somebody with foresight at that point in time to actually start the study. They're also tremendously expensive to keep running. So there is a history then of cohorts stopping and therefore this detailed life course information being lost. So this is, these kind of studies then replicate and enable us to understand life courses, so early life experiences and later life outcomes. But what's been happening in a number of countries, particularly Scandinavian countries and especially Iceland, is that they've started working, usually because of quirks of history, that there's been very good records of families, so siblings, parents, and then parents of parents, so intergenerational data sets. This that they have and have started using in research then large-scale family projects, sorry, large-scale family structures or pedigrees, to use this biological term. Now, these, of course, are very interesting in understanding processes of families, households, and, of course, are very rich when combined with genetic information or used on their own to try and understand genetic processes. Just to give you an example, so Iceland historically had a very good record of its families, and so since the 1950s, the study then has fully reconstructed, that were largely reconstructed, the entire pedigree of Iceland back some 200 or 300 years. Slightly controversially, that's been combined with genetic information by a company within Iceland, and there's some interesting ethical questions. I'm not, in this talk, I'm not really going to touch on the ethical and legal issues, but obviously it goes without saying that there are very important issues to deal with when working with this kind of data. But this is an example of a study. It isn't actually using genetic information, but one that looked at the 1918 Spanish flu. And so it was really trying to ask the question, was genetic variation important in surviving or not the Spanish flu? In other words, might some people be more vulnerable to the flu because of their genetic inheritance? So the way they did this was, because they had this family structure, what they were able to do was to compare, and this is kind of a classic sort of twin-like study design. So they looked at families of patients who succumbed to the illness, and within families of their mates, so in other words, biologically unrelated individuals who had survived. So in that way, they were able to contrast then surviving groups which were biologically related to those that weren't. And actually, their conclusion was there didn't seem to be a genetic variation effect on your chance of surviving flu. You can see here, actually, the mortality rates associated with it. So family and pedigrees, then, are very useful on their own, or with combined with genetic information, then, asking these questions about health, survival, and a wider set of questions. Now, interestingly, I discovered this when I was in Iceland, but Decode, the company that the genetic company had a competition amongst students at the university, I think, to try and make innovative uses of this pedigree they had in Iceland. and this is what they came up with. It's an app for your iPhone. So, and apparently it is a serious issue if you're in Iceland, given the very small population. But it allows you to, if you've got the app, to compare it with somebody you're meeting that will allow you to have a warning about your relatedness. Okay, so these are the interesting developments in other parts of the world, but I'm just going to turn now and spend the rest of talking about work that we've been doing in Scotland that is trying to, in some ways, move us towards this kind of data set. And really, this is premised on the fact that Scotland holds very good vital events records from 1855 to the present day. So that's records of birth, deaths, and marriages. And this is the dome where in New Register House, where all of these records are held. Now, these records are, there's digital images of them, but there's only a limited amount of machine readable, so transcribed records, so information from these records. So part of this work then is around transcribing these records. I'm not going to talk about that. That's a piece of work we're contracting out. But it's a sizable piece of work that hasn't been without its complications. So this is a project then to transcribe around 24 million Scottish vital events records. So this is the records from 1855 to 1974. Beyond 1974, they're already held in machine readable form. And so the long-term goal then is to try and make these records available for researchers both in their form as birth, deaths, and marriages. And as I said, over time, hopefully we're going to increasingly link these into life courses and then hopefully into through family reconstruction into pedigrees. How far we get down that is, I think, still an unknown question. So there's a lot of information on these records, and really this is where I'm going to focus now for the rest of the talk on, really how do you go about dealing with these amounts of records. So for example, I'm going to talk about how we deal with occupational strings, so descriptions of what people were doing. And obviously for research purposes, we want to turn those into something that can be used readily for research. The strings themselves will be of interest, but probably only in small numbers. If you really want to do something across the whole populations, across space then, you need that translated into something useful. So translating 50 million occupational strings. We've got approximately 8 million causes of death. Again, the interest themselves, but if you want to use them for medical research, they need to be translated into something useful. So we then set ourselves the task of trying to translate occupations into a standard classification of occupations, HISCO, which is the historical classification of occupations, to translate deaths into a modified form of the International Classification of Disease, that's the WHO form for coding death and other forms of health events. And also then, as I said at the beginning, to try and give those events a geographical location. To just give you an idea of these kind of records, and also just to point out why the transcription process creates errors. I mean, I look at these and sometimes I can't, even though I know what the name is, I can't read it. So we rely on really quite skillful people then to try and translate these. So this is a death registration. So it records things like the name, when and where the person died, their age. Importantly, it says things on their occupation, where they lived, and on their surviving members of their family. For the marriage then, as you'd expect, it's both those involved directly in the marriage, the parents, and usefully for linking people together then things like the mother's maiden name, which makes the work of linking records over time much easier, and birth registrations as well. Okay, so starting with then occupations. So really what we're trying to do here is to move these rich descriptions of what the person was doing at a particular time then into these far more simplified but research useful things like social class. So that's the process we need to go through. So on the records we have things like description civil servant, farm worker. So the task then is to take these 50 million and to create an effective way then of translating that into these codes. And what we've used in this process then is a process of machine learning. I'll just walk you through that process. Now what machine learning requires is, if you like, a gold standard data set. So in other words, it relies on algorithms to learn the relationship between text strings and a particular code. So one of the things you always need in this process is a gold standard set of data. And for that, at the moment, we've been using the Cambridge Family History Study. It has 60,000 records across this time period, so quite good for us, including given the time period of our records in Scotland. And within this study, then, they have textual descriptions of occupations and then a HISCO code. So in other words, what we want the algorithms to start doing is learning the relationship between those texts and the codes. So we're using HISCO classification. Like many classifications of occupation, it's a hierarchical structure, which is useful. I won't talk much on that, but it's useful to, in terms of uncertainty at lower levels. You might hope that the machine learning classifies at least in the right category, and we have evidence that that happens. So you can see a more detailed horse worker is in the group livestock workers, is in the higher group agriculture and animal husbandry workers, and is in agriculture higher up. So initially though, we're trying to code down to this lowest level, and the results I'll show you are for coding at that lowest level. Okay, so how does the machine learning process work? Well, it starts with taking the set of training data, and usually classically what we do is we take 80% of the gold standard data and use that for training. We separate 20%, which we're going to test how good the algorithm is on. So we take the training data, the algorithm looks at the text, tries to learn the rules, and creates a prediction model. Here's a coded set of occupations. It then takes an unseen set of data that's just unseen to the algorithm. We actually know what the true codes are because it's all taken from the same training data at this stage. This is where we're looking at how good our algorithms are. And then it gives it a predicted classification. So the test, and I'll show you some simplified quality measures, is then how well we do on the unseen data, this random 20%, compared to how well we do because we've actually got the codes that were gold standardly coded. So let me just try and give you an intuition of how that algorithm works. So if you imagine, in a very simplified world, there are only two types of jobs, bank clerk and general manager. And the bank clerks were referred to different ways, so teller, bank clerk, bank teller. But all managers were quite a variety, but factory manager, big factory manager. So what we want to do then is to learn what are the rules that mean that brick factory manager is a text referring to a general manager. And this is an example that illustrates probably just one of the machine learning methods, although they're all reasonably similar. So this uses a bag of words technique, which is very close to the empirical Bayes technique the Bayes technique we use, which actually seems to be one of the most successful ones. So what it does is it just separates out all the words. So we've got a variety of different words here. And what we're trying to do is code into one of these two categories. And then it associates a probability with the term and the category. So for example, bank. Now bank appears in almost all the cases where we're looking at a financial clerk, because if you remember, bank was in bank clerk, bank teller, bank clerk misspelled there. So that has a very high probability of close to 90 or 100%. But if you see bank, it's to do with manager. On the other hand, financial clock. On the other hand, bank is used quite a lot of the time for general manager because there's bank managers, but it's not all of them because you've also got factory managers, so it's about 60%. So what we're trying to do then, if you like, is to divide the terms and the combined terms eventually then to associate with a particular classification. So bank is reasonably good at classifying, but actually you'll misclassify some managers if you just use it on its own. However, if it's bank and manager together, if you imagine adding those two probabilities together and averaging them, then you get a very high probability that it's general manager. If you see bank and clerk and teller together, then it's very high probability it's to do with financial clerk. And the extension then to multiple occupations is just that this is multi-dimensional. What kind of quality can we get then through this simple machine learning process? Well, I've got a very simple measure of accuracy, and this is percentage. This is the times the gold standard zone that the historian who'd worked with this data gave the same classification as we got from our machine learning. So you can see there's a range. I'll just tell you what these different approaches were. But I guess the important thing to see is some of these approaches were pretty poor, so only achieving 30%. So only 30% of the times were they the same. Through to these methods, and this is the Naive Bayes method that I was just describing, which approached 90%. So the poor achieving actually were just a simple kind of string similarity type of comparison, which didn't work well at all. Some machine learning algorithms also failed in this example. And interestingly, this rather simple approach then achieved a very high rate. I won't go into detail, but we also often in this field people use multiple methods and then use a sort of multiple voting system to choose which of the ones they want to use, sometimes weighted by accuracy measures. So 90%, and just to flag, and I'll come back to this at the end, is that so there's a certain level of accuracy, there's obviously inaccuracy in this data. Although these automated processes are necessary, they do introduce error. The use of this data will always come with the caveat that people need to think about the kind of error that's been introduced. Although just to say that when we explore those 10% that are misclassified, in other words, the gold standard, the historian has given a different code, actually, interestingly, what we find is that, and it's quite obvious once you think about it, is that humans are very good at certain things, which is working out complex occupations. But they're not necessarily consistent. So, for example, you find identical strings that have been given different codes by the groups of historians. And so a proportion of that 10% that are wrong, of course, it's arguable. It may just be that these are totally ambiguous, that you could never really associate them with a code. So perhaps that 10% as error is a bit pessimistic. Okay, so that occupations and social class. Second, I'm going to then talk about geography finally. So, standardizing and coding death. So, in many ways, this is a similar approach we've been taking, although actually this field is much more complex, particularly if you're trying to work towards something as complex as the International Classification of Disease, which has many hundreds, thousands of different classifications. What we're translating then is also often a more complex textual description. So this is an interesting set of deaths associated with this event, the Tay Bridge disaster. You look at that picture and you think, didn't everybody think that bridge was going to come down when you look how thin it was? But what's important here is this is the description, I'm not sure what you can say, accidentally drowned from fall of railway train and portion of Tay Bridge into the River Tay. Okay, so now imagine thinking about that translation of that complex bit of text into an ICD-10 code. You're not a human able to interpret it. So this is the kind of problems we're trying to overcome. In the more modern records, then, they're a bit more structured, which is useful. But then, of course, with a greater understanding and therefore complexity of the categorization of disease and illness that goes on with time, of course, what we get is a massive expansion of terminology. There is, of course, this issue of changing terminology that I'm not going to touch on now, but we've had a team actually thinking about that for the past year, how we actually use historical and descriptions of death that have now disappeared, how we fit that then into a modern system like ICD-10. So again, we've got some gold standard historical coded records that we did some early testing with in terms of machine learning. So we had records in this period from Kilmarnock and Skye, I think. Yes, I think I'll just show you the Kilmarnock records. From Tasmania in this period, and Massachusetts in this period. So covering this early work, we were quite interested in how we would deal with 19th century diseases. Now what's important though, which may have made us slightly over-optimistic early on, is that these, because they were the historical causes of death, they had two things. One is they had identified the main cause of death separately. So they'd done a lot of the work that we were expecting the computer to do. And also they used a more simplified schema for coding death. So only 170 classes here, only 36 here, and 94 in the Kilmarnock data. So the job of translating these was made a lot easier by the pre-work. Having said that then, so we went through this, the process of machine learning. Again, I'm showing you accuracy is the same measure. It's the extent to which our machine attributed agreed with the gold standard historian coding. So you can see these are the rates. So for the Kilmarnock, this was unique causes of death, so we made it a bit harder. We just pulled out, we removed all the duplicate causes of death, which are obviously easier to code. But still we got a pretty high level of accuracy, 72 to 84%. Obviously, then that's the unique. So 95 to 96, I think I might have mistimed that. Tasmania, 87 to 93, 84 to 88%. Okay, so that's why I said we were quite optimistic at this stage, because in this slightly simplified form then, we seem to be achieving actually quite a high level of accuracy. And again, when you looked at the gold standard historical records, there are a number of records, actually quite large numbers. You think, well, I'm not sure the machine learning process hasn't got it right. You know, it could be the historian that's wrong. Humans are very good at complex things and not consistent. Machines are just very consistent, not always right. But of course, we then had to face the fact that we actually had a far more complex situation for most of the records. So this is the kind of descriptions you actually get on the record. So these aren't only complex texts, but there are also potentially multiple causes in here. Now really, for historical purposes, what we need to, for research purposes, we need to separate out these different causes. So we've got scarlatina after childbirth. You might want to separate those two. A hemorrhage from the umbilical cord 10 days after birth. Very complex bit of text. This is a great one. Not seen by me until after death, supposed to be caused by septicemia. How do you create a code from that? I mean, that would be difficult even just thinking about it. So there are these, and then really multiple causes of death. So we had a problem here, which was to do two things, to separate out those causes, deal with this complex text, and then move it into a classification of cause of death. So who thinks that's possible? We were certainly, it certainly had us scratching our heads at the time. So we looked at a number, there are, particularly in natural language processing, a number of approaches emerging. So, you know, complex approaches I won't talk about now. Interestingly, just to say, really, that we actually went for this slightly more simple approach that seems to work reasonably well in our case. So what we did was actually quite a simple approach, really, which was, and I'll show you through this example, heart attack, old age. So there's probably two causes of death their heart attack and the fact that the person was old. And ICD-10 would give those two different codes. So what we then did was create the exhaustive set of all the text combinations with the rule that relationship. They had to be two words together or more had to be as they occurred in the sentence. So you can see there we have this exhaustive set of heart attack, old, etc. Okay, so that's the full set of tokens from that string set. We then simply did the same approach we've done through machine learning, the one I described before, and given each of these text descriptions then a code through machine learning, and that's the code they were given. And then this method also gave them a level of confidence. So that's the level of confidence we have that this string heart is related to this heart disease unspecified. I will just illustrate this point actually. Although this shows how we can separate out the code, it actually gives, of course, the wrong code for heart attack. The technical medical term for heart attack is myocardial infarction. So the training data we were using would only have had myocardial infarction written. It would have never had heart attack. So this is part of the danger of using a historical description where someone has actually used the more colloquial term. But you can see then that each of these has been associated with characteristics. If you notice, interestingly, like attack old, of course what it's saying is that the attack is the most important, so that's associated that with asthma attack, although it's given it a relatively low probability. Attack, of course, is a very unspecific term. It's actually associated attack with a stab wound, you kind of expect that, but it has given it a very low probability. So look, the algorithm correctly has said we're not very confident that's the correct one. So the simple approach then we took to trying to unpack both how accurate these were, but then also to create the separate causes, then is to first of all remove very low probability ones, so the attack and stab wounds. And this is a threshold we just set, and we can alter this. And indeed, the ongoing work then is to alter these kind of parameters that we've set. So that leaves this set of characters. We then organize them into the hierarchical structure. So these are all to do with hearts, these to do with asthma, and these to do with the code for old age. And then we set a rule that there can only be a valid set of combinations. So this is the first rule, is that we can only pick one classification from each column. We, the computer, can. So there are legitimate combinations. So this is not valid, because if you notice, attack is used twice from heart attack and asthma attack. So we don't allow that, so that's ruled out. This is a valid combination then, because heart is on its own. Attack now is creating an asthma code. Remember, asthma is the one we don't want, that's the incorrect coding. And age is correct. So that would be okay, so we would allow that. But we have another rule that says, and this is a form of a loss function, that basically says that we sum these probabilities, and the highest combination, then the combination that gets the highest probability is the one we take. So in this case, heart attack was 0.9, old age was 0.9. If you can work through any of the other combinations, they're all lower than that. So in this instance, it takes heart attack and old age, which actually from the start is the one we would want it to do. But of course, with my big caveat that actually, of course, that's wrong. It's not heart disease, it should be myocardial infarction. So this method then has allowed us to do a lot of separation out of complex categorization. We're not yet certain we've got the various things we can tweak correct yet, and we're still ongoing looking at the quality. But it almost always produces a set of plausible categories. When we've discussed it with professional clinical coders, there is some discussion at the moment about how accurate our things are. Okay, so finally, I'm just going to talk then about the geocoding. So for Lee, we've sets of information then in the records and externally. So within the records itself, we have historical addresses. So that's usually usual residence that was associated with the event, so where the person was living when they died, for example, including, obviously, things like building number, street name, and town. Now, very importantly, because this is part of an official administrative process, we also have a registration district number. So that's the registration district for where the event's taken place, and therefore the registration office of where the event was registered. Now, this is extremely useful because, A, this is very well recorded, so none of the... and the address information, I guess, when you give it to a transcriber, is some of the most error-prone pieces of text. So having something that is very accurate then is very useful, and we've used that deliberately within our geocoding process. We also then have a very useful thing, which is very accurately geocoded modern street information. And our initial, at the outset, our starting position, which is one that's been used by other studies then, is that a lot of these, particularly street names and towns, will remain unchanged over time. And so certainly we can start the process of geocoding using this very well geocoded modern information. And then we also have increasingly well easily accessible then historical digitized geolocated maps that can be used obviously with human intervention, we're thinking in this instance, although we are exploring optical character recognition work in this, that can be used then to help with this process of matching modern addresses to historical addresses. So our basic approach then is to, as I said, initially to take modern addresses with their good geocoding and then relate them to these historical events, the historical locations. And this, of course, works some of the time, but not all of the time. So this is an example for around Ladywell House, which is where National Records for Scotland has an office where this data sits, the bits of data that we've already transcribed sit. And we can see that for some of the street names, they are similar or still exist. St John's Road was John's Road in the historical record. Some, though, have, although they seem to be in the same location, have changed their names. So Broome Road has become Ladywell Avenue. Some of them have become more complex. So High Street is now, it's now called Storfin High Street. And some were uncoded, at least in this historical, referenced in this historical record. So whether people were referring to them by a street name or not, we can't tell from the map. So it's clearly another process of deriving information from different sources to try and improve the accuracy of the address system. So this is the what we're working on at the moment. And Costas, who is here, is working at this moment. These are the various bits of software that he's using together in our systems, our geocoding system. So we're, oh, I should point out that we couldn't resist having historical addresses to produce a very good acronym. It's always good to find a good acronym. In this process then, at the moment, we're using, as our matching then, the string similarity measures. This is, we're using the Levenstern distance. I imagine many of you would be familiar with that, but it basically measures the similarity between two words, in this case kitten and sitting, by the number of substitutions you need to make to translate one word into the other. So in this case it's three changes. So if you imagine expressing three over some kind of constraint, which is often the number of characters in the longer word, then you get a proportion of so the quality, the similarity. So this is what we're using then to match the historical addresses as transcribed to to the modern address system. So we've got some pilots. So we have all deaths in 1950 and 1951 transcribed. So this is one of our test data sets. Of course, and you'll see in a moment, this is for geographical purposes, it's possibly slightly too few cases, so we're not able to exploit geography as much as we could or want to. But just to give you an illustration of how successfully then we can match to the modern, so in this case 1950 compared to the contemporary address system. This is some figures for some pilot work. So within that data set we have about 130,000 addresses. In the modern data set there's about 2.6 million. Now we've simplified, we don't try and do house numbers at the moment, we're simply working towards road or street centroids. So when we simplify that down, then we get around 87,000 unique roads. Of that, then, some of them are very poorly transcribed. If a transcriber couldn't read the address at all, they put in a question mark, which of course is extremely unhelpful in terms of trying to match the street. And that sort of, in terms of the contemporary address data system, when you simplify to roads, then that there's about 270,000 streets in Scotland. So what COSSUS has been doing is testing various quality of Levenstein matches. So this is where a string text is 100% similar. So in other words, it's identical in terms of the transcribed records, and we find a match in the historical record. You can see if you try and have that kind of quality, you actually geocode a very small proportion of our records, only about 1%. So you can see here that you get increasing amounts of matches as you drop the quality of the match. And of course there you're increasing the risk that you're incorrectly geocoding a street. What COSSUS has spent a lot of time, I think, in doing is refining the algorithms. So at least now we're running these under manageable times. Anybody who's done these kind of matching algorithms will know it can absorb an enormous amount of computing time, which when you're working with many millions of cases, obviously, actually is quite significant, particularly if you're trying to tweak things. But clearly, then, 60% match at 60% similarity there doesn't seem a very good result. And I guess that's probably right. So what we've always been aware of, that we have this benefit in having the registration district information available, because these matches, of course, are against all addresses in Scotland, but because we actually had this bit of information, this geographical, if you like, bound for our data, we actually can do much better by searching just within this smaller geographical area, and there we may be far more confident about knowing this accuracy level, because we think actually we'll still probably find the correct addresses. But this does mean that we need to do something, which I was always a bit surprised if anybody in the audience can correct me, then that would run into here, that we don't really think over this 150-year period there are good geocoded registration district boundaries existing. I know Richard is working on some of them for Edinburgh, but we haven't found it. But then, of course, actually we realised that we didn't actually need them. So we could create, in effect, pseudo-boundaries because we had the information on the address relating to a particular registration district, and we had the registration district, and we knew we could code certainly a proportion of records. So it then became clear to us that, of course, we could at least reconstruct approximately the boundaries. And so this is the piece of work that COSSUS is working on at the moment. We haven't quite refined it, it's still early days, but just to give you some idea then. So here we have all the 1950 death records that we could match. This was with an 80% greater than, is that 80%?
Yes.
Yeah. So this is as you'd expect. They're hovering over urban areas of Scotland. So in the process then of trying to automate to reconstruct the registration district boundaries, then we would create these in polygons around these events. Actually, at the moment, these events are the combined cases of events at a particular road junction. So Costa is working on weighting them by the actual number of events, which will actually improve the algorithm. So here it is for Edinburgh. So what we're trying to do here is to, in 1950, split Edinburgh into five or six registration districts. But I'll just show you for how we were able to start distinguishing two registration districts. This is the Edinburgh Thesian polygons then, and it's coloured by the different registration districts. So a registration district has its own colour. And then you can see actually that's quite a random pattern. I think I was slightly depressed when I saw that. And that's actually because, partly because we're, at the moment, we're not weighting also by the number of events, which will help. It also revealed, which we hadn't really realised before, was that if you had an event away from your home, in other words, in another registration district, actually you could have multiple registrations. So a death, for example, might be registered in two places. But also, of course, in a city, because we're combining streets, we might well have longer roads or streets that actually go over boundaries. But so Costa has been working on various algorithms to try and clean that up. And so he's developed a point density score. I'll show you that in a moment. But hopefully you can see that it's starting to make a particular set of these polygons stand out more as a single registration district. So you can see here, if you squint, that's looking more like a continuous. This I just think is a cheat, actually, now I think about it. But we actually, this is not automated. We're still thinking about the zoning system to do it. But this is by eye, so without referring to actually where the registration district is bounded, of trying to bound records that seem to lie more consistently with a registration district. And then you can see this a bit more clearly when Costas has combined these scores together, which also creates a set of unknowns, but you can see that on the whole this then starts more consistently having a defined polygon in the correct registration district. And this actually I've been trying to work back from other sources to what the registration districts looked like in 1950, and we hadn't seen these before, and actually this is Haymarket here. We actually do replicate, although it actually goes higher up into the sort of the dock areas, but of course there's not many people living there, so there weren't many events, so that's why I don't think we'd really be able to classify up here. Actually we're starting to reasonably bound the registration districts at this quite early stage. Just to show you the density measures that Costas was doing, so here's the density for the Haymarket the district polygon, and just to show you how this registration district then differentiates itself, there's the point density for that. So it's going to be some kind of combination of these techniques, although as we get more data and we introduce a weighting for events, I think we'll be able to identify these borders more clearly. Just to finally show you, this is this issue. So this is 1950 deaths in a Haymarket registration district, and we can see actually that clearly there were people that in this instance died away from Edinburgh, so they probably got duplicate records which we're going to need to clean out. Okay, so I'm just going to finish there, and I guess I'll make two points in closing. First of all, our end point, our goal with this data is to try and create a complexity and richness of data that exists with these more modern sources. And these are just two examples that I've pulled off the web, but maybe kind of illustrate the kind of richness that we'll have in this historical data when we finish processing it. So these very complex forms of transformation, so for example, social mobility across generations, and of course, being able to look at those kind of transformations will have whole populations across space. So thinking about ways of analysing and representing these very complex data, you know, it's great producing this, but if we don't have ways of analysing or showing it to illustrate patterns, then of course it will be useless. But it may well be that through this rich geolocated data, this is Manhattan, obviously, and it's people's Flickr accounts, so it's people taking pictures and their geolocation. But again, we get this richness of spatial information. So for example, people marrying. So it might be interesting to look at where there were marriages across social boundaries and class groups, where that was happening. So again, there's this complexity. The second point to make is, and I hope I've illustrated this, that these techniques are getting us a certain way, but there's still a lot of uncertainty and inaccuracy in the data. So clever ways of thinking about how we analyse this data with this error. It may well be largely at random, which means that perhaps we can work with the data, the sort of completed data or the coded data. On the hand, we're going to have to think about also where, particularly where linkages, and I'm sure you can very readily think about cases of unusual cases, therefore special groups, which would be more or less likely to be accurately coded using the systems we're using. And so actually there may well be important biases to think in these large-scale analysis as well. So just two final points to leave with.
Keeping us all in work, isn't it, until this the Glasgow effect.
I think what I'd be very excited to look at is the extent to which that might be to do with these processes over time, historical. So, I mean, importantly, which I think hasn't really been explored, is the fact that social mobility and then the redistribution of health is also about spatial mobility. So, for example, the extent to which people growing up in Glasgow at the point of deindustrialisation were or weren't able to move, which people did move and therefore benefit, and therefore the distribution of various forms of capital within Scotland. Hopefully we will be able to look at when we have this intergenerational data, so really look at understanding social mobility, which is often ignored by sociologists, the spatial component, so the extent to which migration might allow understanding of that. So I think it will be some of the tools which hopefully we can start understanding that situation.
I'm no statistician, but I suppose my big question is that you said right at the beginning that some results hadn't come through and you couldn't present them. But I suppose my big question is that there's a whole load of methods here, but does it actually work?
Yeah.
I mean, all of this number crunching, anything coming out the far end that's useful?
Yeah. Well, so, I mean, you're quite right, there's a complexity of methods here, and once they're combined, there's a lot of methods and estimation in them. I guess that's my point about uncertainty. It will be important for people analysing to understand this, and part of what we're going to try and do is provide estimates of that, estimates of uncertainty, which then will be useful within the analysis, and anybody who's using this effectively will do. I mean, hopefully I have shown where we have got accuracy or not. So, we are getting these, I think, reasonable quality of coding of mortality and occupation. And remember, that we're comparing it against the gold standard data that have been used by historians and historical demographers over the last 50, 60 years. So and we're finding that probably their coding is not always accurate. So I guess I'd say, okay, there's definitely a complexity, but probably there's no more complexity or various decision making that lie behind the classic historical demography studies that are used at the moment. But I think you're quite right to be cautious, and that's why we need to think cleverly about how we make sure people correctly have that uncertainty in their estimation.
Well, that's a good idea to follow. So does that mean then that what you're going to do from this is produce data, the whole set of certainties and uncertainties and probabilities, for somebody else to analyse?
Well,
in other words, you're producing
data.
Sorry.
Yeah, so I should have said this, yeah. So the point of this is, obviously we'll use it to analyse, but this will be a national resource that can be used by researchers. So that's why it's important to have these estimates, because we're close to this process, and we know that we need to convey that to other researchers who are going to use this data.
Well, I go just because mine's kind of follow up to that one as well, which is, I think you said this is probably only going to be available for research data, for research use, which in some ways is kind of a shame, because if you could get that out to the public, you crowdsource the solution to that problem, because all your family historians would say,
checking.
Oh no, that's not correct, and would very quickly identify
your
problems and fix these.
Yeah, you see, and Bruce, that's very useful to point out, because obviously one of the logical sources that have been used elsewhere by the Latter-day Saints, for example, is to crowdsource this kind of data. We, for commercial reasons, not our own, and legal reasons, have to work in this framework. But yes, I quite agree. Although crowdsourcing does bring its own problems. So the Dutch use this with their civil registration, and problems of accuracy, variable accuracy and various coverages result from having local groups and individuals coding this data. We're consistent with our errors, I guess, is one advantage.
Yeah, a little
there.
I think we'll work back.
I just wondered, because of this detailed geographic data on events, the more need for detailed geographic data on population over time, because it strikes me that you're going to have lots of information about where people die and where they'll abort. That small geographic
data.
The censuses are not so good in the historic censuses.
That's right. And I think, and so Alice Reed and Ailey Garrett, the public Cambridge historical group, are very interested in this, comparing it. For example, the Register General was saying, because will have been referring to these same records, but reporting on events and these same areas. So, it'll be an interesting new view on top of these existing historical records. Obviously, in some ways, we might use these for validation, but hopefully we have a greater geographical refinement as well. Is that answering your question?
Although, I think my question is, you don't know the denominator.
Okay, you mean if we're creating rates? That's going to take some clever thinking. But this is part of the advantage of just producing the research data sets. We can have the community trying to solve this. Yeah, I mean, I think we're thinking, as I sort of sketched at the beginning, our initial thinking is more on this sort of life course pedigree type research, rather than creating. But we're obviously interested also in thinking about how you create standalone data from this as well.
Angus, I think, and then I'll put along.
Maybe a slightly two-hander question. In terms of modern, where does historic stop and modern data kind of start? And also, what you've learned from how folk code things and whatever, what's the sort of seam between what historical data and modern data? And also, given that you mentioned the fact you can back the original text strings and the same text string has been coded differently, by different people, by this, possibly the state, but presumably there's kind of maybe kind of trends as well over what's cause and effect and critical things as well.
Yeah.
All sorts of a complex range of things. What does that say about archiving, the need to kind of, I mean, archive original material, and given the modern era where the original material is digital?
Yeah.
Then, you know, what? Sorry, that's kind of all conflicted.
No, that's really interesting. I mean, in terms of the division, actually, just to, I don't think this is directly answering your question or talking to your point necessarily, but we have an important, so in 1974, it's actually when there's these machine-readable records. Now, whether that means modern or not, I don't know. What would be important for us is, and we haven't really completed this process, that we have a legal research strand that is thinking about this. But, for example, in Scandinavia, which is far more used to making these kind of records available, the data which a record is seen as more confidential, because although these are all open records that you can look, go into your register house and look up birth and death, at what time, at what point then we'll have to think differently about how we access it and how secure we hold it is an important point between modern and old. But just to reflect on your last point, I do think that you do become very aware of with these paper records that, of course, although are difficult to use, actually are very resistant to degradation over time compared to electronic records. And you do, you know, the richness of this data that you can absorb, and going back to the original and then be able to look at what's happened, it does make you think that, you know, there is an enormous danger. So we're working with, we work with the census, and you do realise that these large holdings of electronic tape, magnetic tape versions of it, are on the point of disappearing. And, you know, decision making and equipment, you know, could mean that some of these massive resources are lost because paper records haven't been kept. Just one final point on that is that, and we haven't really looked into this, but obviously we've become aware that comparing a very consistent machine system against how people think is a very good way of teasing out understanding conceptualization, how that changed over time, how it changed between people. So on the sort of back burner, by the back of my mind, I'd be really interested to work with some psychologists and sociologists thinking about, maybe medical historians, about how even, you know, from researching researchers, how they were thinking about disease over time.
There's an image record, so you've got an image of the page from the register, yeah, or whatever. Does that mean that the register is no longer relevant? I was in Edinburgh Council a couple of years ago in the planning department, and these days, the architect plans for whatever planning comes in, they scan them. And then the original paper is just forbidden because you don't have the space to do it. Is that fine? Is that adequate? Is that scan?
Yeah.
You've got the image of the bit of paper, therefore actually the original bit of paper is, you know, will not add anything more to the image, so therefore you don't actually have to keep the original bit of paper.
No, I think that's an important point, because increasingly those type of decisions are being made, yeah.
Obviously, it's kind of the early stages of a really big project, and I think all of the questions that people have asked will really be able to be answered once you've got the database kind of configured, and in a way that then you can correlate these other kind of studies where you cross correlate, say, income and health expectation with, you know, occupation is a proxy for social condition and those kind of things. And so it's probably unfair to kind of judge the outcome yet, I would say. This is a necessary first step. So the real hard work will come when you try and bring it, put it together with health or genomics.
Stuff
like that. That's when we'll start to get answers.
So with the computer scientists, we're thinking a lot about how actually this data and its relationships will be held. So we're thinking about, you know, whether graph databases are necessary compared to more relational type of structured databases. But then also really how it's a kind of a fluid, organic structure that can change. And so this doesn't help with the what's right type question, but we'll allow researchers to make decisions and then there'll be an extract depending on their decisions. But also, the idea is then also to use the links as we create it to either increase or decrease our certainty in various decisions that have been made on the data. So, I mean, whether that makes this thing that never stabilises, I don't know, but I mean, that's a computer science question we're interested in.
So, one technical question. Why not just use normal Bayesian methods as opposed to machine learning, you know, formally bring in expert opinion or other forms of prior knowledge, you know,
Yeah. I mean, that may be interesting. I think it's probably just what we've been working with it at the moment. No, it's an interesting point.
Bob, do you get the final question?
Can I ask a couple of questions? And a broader one. There's a, you know, you probably covered this already, but there's something of a genealogical research industry in Scotland.
Yeah.
I don't know very much about it, but I just wondered if you've been liaising with them, I think they might be able to provide a few tips. Or some insights. On the registration district thing, do people, I'm not sure historically, do people have to register vital events within their own, within the registration district in which, you know, that they lived? And did they always know what that was? And then, more general question.
Yeah.
I mean, I would guess the Scandinavians have been able to go a bit further more easily because they have such resolved centres as very good records. Obviously, you're in the early stages of a vast enterprise. Presumably, that some of the Scandinavians have gone a bit further. Have some encouraging results come out of what they've done.
So genealogy community, first of all. So, we had this slight issue that we're having to develop this for research use. So, unfortunately, there's this boundary that's sort of created between these two communities. But we're already working in particular with genealogies that have been used in research already, so to try and identify sort of gold standard family structures. Mm-hmm. And indeed, we're also working, there's a unit within information, the NHS, that actually creates pedigrees, particularly for genetic counselling. So we'll think about when we come on to create automatedly our genealogies, and obviously, and we've already done this exploration, so comparing genealogies created by a person is very useful, again, as a kind of a comparison to see how effective our automated processes are. So the registration districts, we're discovering more about registration districts as we go along, and actually I'm not the expert in that, it's other parts of the team, but as I said, we now are discovering that we can have multiple registrations where. So the requirement was that registration. Lee, can you remember? Is Lee here? No. Tom. Yes. So we have these multiple registrations where someone has died away from their registrations, being registered in their local district. But then presumably the requirement that they're also registered in their local district has happened. So we have these multiple cases. So. So there are the rules, they are being followed, but it does create these quirks in the data. And your final point, I've question, yes. So your final question was?
There was the big issue of Scandinavia versus...
That's right, yeah. So, yes, we're working very closely with the Scandinavia. Interestingly, although Iceland is way ahead in terms of its research use of these data sets, actually, Sweden, and Norway, although they've got existing data sets, actually in terms of their this kind of data set and used for health and genetic research. Actually, it's not that much further ahead of us. But we're collaborating and learning and exchanging techniques here, so it's extremely useful. And there's a European network of similar studies. So hopefully over time there might actually be the potential for creating comparative studies in these different parts of Europe as well.
Okay. Great. Well, I think it's probably time to hold any other further questions to Geodrix. Thank you all for coming. So, yes, Geodrix, the library bar, if you wish to carry on, do join us. Thanks, everyone, for coming along. Next talk, I think, is a fortnight's time on something completely different. Remote sensing talk, Friday the 13th, so I expect you all for that date. But glad to see so many people and some new faces today. So it just remains to say thank you very much to Chris for a very interesting talk. Thank you.